In this episode, we discuss the video How Amsterdam Invented Capitalism and consider how what took place in Amsterdam actually reveals some of the inherent contradictions in what people think of as capitalism. Hello, welcome to the Call Like I See It podcast. I'm James Keats, and joining me today is a man whose money trees can provide enough shade for all. Tunde Ogonlana. Tunde, are you ready to hit us with some poetic justice today?
Nah, man, you can't give away all my secrets. I'm gonna have people stalking me now for money. Come on, man, you can't.
My bad, man.
Yeah. I don't have any money, guys. I'm poor.
Then they gotta know you're a serious guy, man. That's all.
No, man. I'm the poorest guy you ever met. That's it. Jeez, you're gonna mess me up here.
Now, before we get started,
can't have my kids listening to this. I just told them that we can't buy lunch today. What are you talking about?
And before we get started, if you enjoy the show, I ask that you subscribe, like the show on YouTube or your podcast app. Doing so really helps the show out. We're recording on July 7th, 2026. And Tunde, you recently resent a video to me on YouTube. It's called How Amsterdam Invented Capitalism. And I know you had watched it a while back. It came out in 2025, or it was posted in 2025 on this on the page Show Me the World. And you had recently resent it. And so we watched it, wanted to talk about it for the show. Now, the video goes through the circumstances that led Amsterdam to becoming a huge financial center. And, you know, you go back a few 400 years or so, including the creation of the Dutch East India Company in Amsterdam and the creation of the first stock exchange shortly thereafter. And also how the seeds were set. The video also touched on how the seeds were set for London and New York to eventually become financial centers in their own right. Now, looking at the video, you know, we're looking at all this. What stood out in this video as far as what it presents as far as Amsterdam having invented capitalism?
Several things stuck out. It was a pretty fascinating video, actually. I would say a couple things. The two things primary to me were timing, that the Dutch were kind of in the crosshairs of a lot going on in the world, not just Europe at the time. And so it's kind of this timing of, you know, advances in technology, you know, what was going on kind of geopolitically with which countries and the empires were siding with who, all that. And the Dutch seemed to have a nice kind of, you know, like the three bears, their porridge was just right. So I think that to me was interesting. And then the other thing was going back to something that we got from the book Sapiens. I really kept thinking this is a true imagined order, this capitalism thing, this idea of a company that issues shares and that there's value and that you can be a shareholder and hold on to those shares and that the performance of, you know, how that company operates can increase your wealth over time. I mean, all those were new concepts because that allowed people who weren't in the nobility, weren't wealthy through a bloodline to actually begin to participate in wealth. And I think that is a very
in general, because remember, at least in Europe at that time, you're coming out of a feudal system where it's like land is tied to wealth, and if you don't have land then you're not wealthy. But this was the rise of the merchant, you know, class of wealth.
So that's what I'm saying. Like, to me, that the timing of what was going on, along with that, the fact that they created this new imagined order, and it really, you know, you think about the last 400 years, the world is profoundly different than it was for the prior 4,000 years. I mean, you know, it seems like this technological advancement and all that, a lot of it has been stoked by if I can say it this way, James, the passions, right? Maybe the incentives that capitalism and this idea of like all the exploration, all that was able to because of this new imagined order. So to me, that was,
and so that's good because we have less overlap here, because I'd say that the things that stood out to me, one was how care was taken to talk about how in Amsterdam at that time you had refugees and people from a lot of different places and how they didn't bog themselves down with the religious disputes that had consumed Europe at the time or things like that. Like, people were able to do them. And, you know, and so as a result, because you're not fighting over this and fighting over that, and then also you're bringing in refugees, but, you know, different ideas, you know, immigrants, you do all this stuff. And new things are being created. You know, like there's a it's more dynamic in society because of those things. So that piece was interesting to me, just that this isn't just the, hey, everybody who's been here or everybody who's here has been here for 1,000 years and so forth. But there's people coming and going and new ideas and so forth. The other thing, though, was I spent a lot of the time trying to connect because, you know, the title of the video, and titles of videos, you know, it's YouTube, you know, the title of the video doesn't necessarily have to track exactly to what you're going to learn or anything like that. But the video is, you know, how Amsterdam invented capitalism. So I spent much of the video trying to figure out, okay, well, what did Amsterdam invent that we then consider capitalism? You know, so from what I gathered, you know, okay, yes, the Dutch East India Company and the issuance of tradable stock, you know, stock that could then be traded, and the issuance of that to anybody there in Amsterdam wanted to buy some, they could buy some, and then it could be traded. The reason it could be traded, I found to be interesting in that, investing in one of these ships that was going to go to Asia for spices, typically it was a one shot deal. Like you invest in a ship, and then that ship comes back, and you get your money. You know, you get your investment. If the ship comes back, you get your money back plus whatever profits made, and then done deal. And in this instance, what the Dutch East India Company did was to say, hey, no, you got to put your money in. You're going to put it in for 10 years, period. And so from that, then it's like, well, somebody wanted to get out. You need to have a secondary market for that. And so that's how you end up having these tradable stocks, and that you create a stock exchange in that sense. So I was looking at that. But what wasn't invented, so to speak, and a lot of times when people talk about capitalism, a lot of other things are a part of it. You know, like, oh, it's about the free market. Anytime you hear capitalism, people are like, oh, yeah, free markets and this and that. And so I was very curious and very interested to hear what exactly, and that's what I got out of it. And you're talking, you know, a corporation that issues tradable stock and stock markets and so forth, which is parts of capitalism, but there's other things that people think are inherent to capitalism, but maybe we should question whether those things are inherent to capitalism or that that's the only way that capitalism can be done.
Yeah, man, I think it's very interesting. You bring up the immigrant part that stuck out to me too, that Amsterdam. So it seems like the areas that have historically and maybe in this system of capitalism, right, done very well, if you look at their geographies, is places that have high concentrations of people coming into them from other places, people that are motivated, you know, to get out of wherever they were to go into this new area. And I think that was interesting to learn about Amsterdam, just so much activity. And, you know, there was a historian, I'm going to definitely say that I didn't invent this quote, but I found it great. A historian I saw being interviewed once, he said, history is always being made while something else is happening. And I thought, when I was watching this documentary, I thought about that, because think about what the Dutch were really doing. It was all about competition, because they were trying to, they didn't like that the Ottomans had a lock on the trade of spices and other goods from India and China, kind of from the East, right? And once the technology changed in the crankshaft was created, where they could build ships 30 times faster and for cheaper than their neighboring empires or countries in Europe, then all of a sudden they said that within a few years, these ships started coming back full with all these goods. And that's what gave rise to the ability of people wanting to say, hey, let's raise more money. If we can raise more money, we can go out and get more goods that we can sell back into Europe. So it was the beginning of this enterprise mindset of looking at this idea of, let's go somewhere else and get these raw materials, these commodities. We can bring them back here, refine them into something else, and then sell them in our backyard and make a spread, make a profit. And I think that to me was also interesting, that there's all this stuff going on all the time in the world. And that's where the timing, the technology, all was at. The Dutch just had this, by the invention of the crankshaft, certain thing, the ability to get more ships out quicker than the Portuguese or the Spanish, they're now able to dominate shipping routes and all that. And that changes the trajectory. But then raising money for this company also changes the way that things happen.
Yeah, that actually, there's another piece with that. And that goes into this merchant class. Because one of the reasons, you know, they talked about, like, there was no king in Amsterdam. You know, there was a republic.
It
was a republic. And as a result, though, the people who, like, the Spanish and the Portuguese at that time, particularly, I think, the Portuguese, but then also the Spanish, were well established in this route, the sea route to Asia. You know, land route goes through, you know, where you can imagine goes through Europe and then Asia through the Ottoman Empire, or, you know, whoever's ruling in Turkey at that moment. And the sea route goes around Africa and then up through to India and then Eastern Asia. And with that, you had the Portuguese and the Spain, these things were being done on behalf of the crown, you know, generally speaking. Whereas in Amsterdam, they're being done by merchants. And that's where you talk about this unending drive. You know, like when you're working for the crown, it's like, okay, yeah, I can do a little better myself. You know, I'll stay somewhat motivated, and, or, you know, like they might lock me up if I don't stay motivated or whatever. But this merchant class, their potential benefit was limitless. Like there was no, like the more they, you know, and the crankshaft was an important invention they talk about in there, and just in terms of being able to build ships faster. So once that happens, there's no limit to how much money they can make. Yeah. You know, it's not being taken off by the crown, or it's not the crown saying, oh, I got enough ivory back scratchers now. You know, we'll only send one ship this year. You know, it's like they keep building ships. They keep going. They keep investing. They can keep getting more and more money. You know, like their demand was insatiable. So if they could keep bringing in the supply. So that also was a distinct thing of the merchant class, so to speak, being the ones running the show, the guys who were enterprising already, and not the people that were born into some position that were just, you know, like, hey, you know, we were born here. Our dad was here. And so, yeah, we're good to go, you know. So,
yeah,
that, like I thought that was a distinguishing
point. I think, I just follow up on that before we keep going. I think that's an excellent observation, because I did recognize it, and I'm glad you brought it up, because as you're saying, it makes me realize too, think about it. Had there been a king in the Dutch Republic or whatever, the merchants may not have had an opportunity to get this far with this, because think about it. Anybody else with any wealth by a certain level is a threat to the monarch. So yeah. That's probably, you know, and to your point about, I didn't think about it, but the crankshaft probably wouldn't have happened either if it was a monarchy, because there wouldn't have been that drive by just the merchant class to keep trying to get better at something, you know, because like you said, the king might just be it's, like, oh, well, I don't yeah, feel like going this year.
Limitless benefits. Yeah. It's just limitless. Like, hey, we could just keep making more and more and more. You know? And,
so I found that very,
the people that are in power are there because of merit and not because of nepotism. You know, and so that makes a difference in terms of the kind of people and the kind of mentalities you're talking about.
Right.
And then also not being threatened by there. You don't have a king being threatened by the growth and wealth and so forth.
Now you can stop, because I'm getting depressed. Is that you're talking, I'm realizing, oh, we're losing our republic here. We're going into
nepotism.
Some monarchy nepotism system. That's not good. That doesn't seem to be the right direction.
But one of my
questions I have for you is, did you, like, because in watching the documentary, I thought it was very interesting. Obviously, we're having a good conversation about it, but I wanted to know, because you're good at pointing out sometimes these contradictions or inconsistencies. Did you feel that there were any, besides, like you said, maybe just the definition of what is capitalism? But I know
I'll read a definition of capitalism just from Webster's. An economic system characterized by private or corporate ownership of capital goods, by investments that are determined by private decisions, and by prices, production, and distribution of goods that are determined mainly by competition in a free market. Well, again, like that's three different things that they're saying are defining characteristics of capitalism. But, you know, the Dutch East India Company was founded as a way to form a monopoly. So then that leads me to question. So are markets inherently part of capitalism? Or can you have a capitalist type of system with the private ownership and so forth, and that doesn't involve markets? And I think, you know, that makes me look around today. You know, it's like, okay, yeah, like we see actually in a capitalist system, essentially a capitalist system can't sustain itself absent a regulatory environment that prevents too much monopoly, because what ends up happening when we see these capitalist systems, the drive for profit leads a drive for consolidation. It doesn't lead to a drive for healthy competition. Healthy competition seems to be something that has also been determined to be helpful in a capitalism system, not something that's inherent in the capitalism system. So a lot of times, it would be helpful for us to realize when we talk about these types of things that, oh, yeah, we got to have capitalism, we got to have markets. And it's like, well, no. Capitalism and markets don't coexist inherently. You can have the capitalism piece by saying, okay, yeah, private ownership, you know, government, keep your hands out of the ownership piece of people that are doing capital goods. And that's capital goods again. That's not talking about police stations and roads, but you know, keep government stay out of that. But then government, we need you to prevent monopolies. We need you to create a market, to create a stock market. I mean, you can go on and on about talking about how when you have an unregulated stock market, what ends up happening, you know, when there's no SEC, there's no this and that, it becomes predatory. It becomes something that is not something that's growing.
What if you only had one company on the exchange? Like you're saying, like, let's say it was a true monopoly. You wouldn't have, there would be no market, to your point. That's why I think it's a great point. If you had one company on the Dow Jones and that's it, there's no real market because who are you trading those shares with? Who, you know, so I think it's a good point. Sorry, did you finish?
But no, all I'm saying is that a lot of times there's an assumption that all these things naturally come with capitalism. That's why, again, when I came into the documentary, what did they actually invent? And then what about these other things that we think about are actually things that have been added to it to make it work better? Because I worry that we live in a time right now where a lot of the things that have been added to it to make it work better for the benefit of everyone and the enterprising in particular are being stripped away.
Yeah, so you bring up some interesting things because I think we can look now back at the 400-year trajectory of this capitalism. And I think that it's a very good point that they purposely created a monopoly at the beginning of this with the Dutch East India Company to compete against the other empires, the British, and the Spanish and the Portuguese at the time being the most dominant. It's interesting because I recently got through down a rabbit hole about the history of the British East India Company because I saw a quote from Adam Smith, who was the author of The Wealth of Nations, which is one of the first big tomes of, you know, how to run these big financial systems. And I was pleasantly surprised to learn that Adam Smith really disliked the British East India Company. Yeah. And what he said about it was basically what you just said. He was criticizing it in the 1700s because he felt that it was such a monopoly on the British economy and the British system that the British people actually were the ones suffering, and a few people at the top of the British society were really benefiting. And he felt it was corrupt and all that. And it's interesting, like the Gilded Age before, you know, I guess what we call the first one.
Like what we have in our society right now.
But think about this, James, and this is what I learned. Then guess what? The British crown and the government itself would... the British taxpayers and the taxes from all the colonies had to bail out the British East India Company for overextending itself in India in 1773.
Yeah.
How did they then deal with the British crown with trying to, you know, repatriate themselves for bailing out this company that, you know, they started taxing the colonies more. And they, wow. Three years later in 1776, because you know what the true story was? They started taxing the tea. So the American colonists started buying tea from the Dutch and that pissed off the crown and started this whole thing. And so what I'm saying is that's why I love that quote that historian said is history is made while something else is happening. Because even going back to the American Revolution, right? It all stems from this Dutch East India Company and then the British East, you know, this whole way of that capitalism was figuring itself out. And I think you're right. I think the New Deal, and maybe starting with Teddy Roosevelt with the Square Deal and the trust busting and the antitrust.
Yeah.
So the American system, let's say by the early 20th century, may have been the first to do what you said, really say, oh, hold on. We got to make sure the government actually seems to be the only entity that could be powerful enough to stop these oligarch monopolists.
Yeah.
Because like I said, maybe in the other discussion we had in a recent show that it's kind of since the French Revolution, we've been seeing these kind of booms and busts in societies based on when you get this equilibrium out of balance when it gets too out of balance between the top and the bottom of society. And I think that, the New Deal was one of the, and maybe post-World War II European, like the Scandinavian, the Canadian, that kind of like system where it's capitalist, but they do have that sprinkle of let's just have a safety net, let's have the public health care options and all that. And I think, you know, that might be the way that societies have tried to counter that monopolistic reality. I wouldn't even say reality.
It's monopolistic. Well, and then, you know, Ricardo talks about this. It's you drive the wages below sustenance, you know, or wages go to
correct.
If you just allow the capitalist impulse to go, the capitalist impulse, it's like an engine. It can be allowed, it can be ridden, but it will explode if you don't put the right frame on it. You know, and so that to me, and so again, back to the question of what did the Dutch actually invent? Well, they invented kind of, or they took us, started taking us down this road of this incredible engine that can take you to the moon. But if you don't put the right framework on it, then you'll end up destroying your habitat, you know, the earth, you know, yeah. a few hundred years or a few 50 years, you know, like whatever. You'll make it so that you can't even live here anymore because there's no check on that engine naturally. Not markets aren't a natural check. Because the capitalists will get rid of the markets and become a trust, become a monopoly. And so you have to have something to keep the markets in place that keeps, and then you have to have something that makes sure that wages and workers can get a fair shake. If you don't have that, again, the capitalists, they won't happen. If the capitalist impulse is to not give the workers a fair shake, you know, because it's the same things that make the engine powerful are the same things that make it so it won't do those other things.
Yeah. No, I agree.
All right. So, my last question on this, though, is because we talk about this kind of stuff from time to time, you know, like, and I'd say from the rise of quote unquote rents over profits, which was discussed in Yanis Varoufakis's techno-feudalism, which we discussed a couple years ago, to what we've seen recently with the U.S. government, actually, you know, since, you know, in the last year, U.S. government's been taking positions, ownership positions with various companies like Intel. Do you think the form of capitalism or proto-capitalism that was invented in Amsterdam, supposedly, you know, apparently, still exists? Like, are we still doing the same thing? Or again, do we just think we're doing the same thing? Or do we think that whatever we're doing is capitalism because that's kind of just the way our mindsets are, but actually what we're doing is something that is different than that in a way that may be better or worse?
Good question, man. I think we're still doing the capitalism thing, but I think for the conversation we've been having, right, it's continuing to evolve. And I think, you know, it's a good point you make about the U.S. government taking positions in publicly traded and privately held companies. I mean, the latest I heard is the people that run OpenAI, for example, have now are courting the U.S. government about taking a stake in that company. And you're right about Intel. I learned recently that the U.S. government took a position in U.S. Steel. And that's to me like, all right, I thought that socialism, the definition of it is when the government owns the means of production. And I'm thinking like, okay, Intel's producing chips. You know, yeah. U.S. Steel produces steel. Yeah. Like
There's others too.
It seems like means of production to me, right?
So that's the first part of the definition is private ownership. Now we're starting to have U.S. government doing it. That's
what I'm saying. So and also, James, things that, again, and this is not to get off topic, right? But what do the American people want? Because they always say they don't like China, but it looks like this is kind of the direction we're going. It's kind of state, quasi-state owned companies. And on the political side, maybe having one party just deciding all that stuff, right?
Single party rule.
And so that seems to be a monopoly in business, monopoly in politics, like where things are going. I don't know if that is capitalism's fault or if that is a function of just technology and how we as human beings are organized and all this stuff and a combination of all that. But I do think, James, that, yeah, I think maybe part of it is technology that at some point, the idea of ownership, the idea of all that was different than maybe today with technology of streaming and subscription services. The idea of rents is really can like, I sent you an article recently. I don't know how much you had maybe a chance to see it, but it was about PlayStation that by January of 2028, they're no longer going to have discs. It's all going to be, and I just thought the same thing. I was like, hold on. So if my internet goes out, I can't play a game.
Yeah.
Because right now I got discs for my PS5. So at least when the internet goes out, if there's a rainstorm or something, as long as I have electricity, I can put the disc in and play it. I feel like I own that disc.
Yeah.
But now I'm going to be paying rent to PlayStation. I'm just going to pay for the ability to get on their platform when it works. Yeah. And that's it. And if they want to change anything of that, it's going to affect me.
If they want to change the game after you've bought it.
So that's all I'm saying is I don't know if that is pure capitalism or not capitalism. I just think that this is going to continue to evolve.
I think that's the key piece is that it capitalism is not static. You know, whatever was invented then, like what we're doing now would be unrecognizable to Adam Smith.
Correct. Yeah.
You know, based on what he talked about, it would not be something he would be thinking is a good thing, you know, in that sense. Yeah. Like, and so I do think that it's a continued evolution. And this is what I think people who aren't just the greedy, I think the greedy people know this already. It's going to change. And so what you want to do is change it in ways that benefit you, or that benefit if you have anything higher than yourself that you care about, a general society or a system. It's going to change. So the New Deal changed it. You know, the New Deal changed capitalism in ways that I think benefited a society. It's been changed since then. The idea of importing trickle down in economics and so forth has fundamentally changed the way that it works. And so if you understand that it's going to change, what I think a lot of times, like, again, greedy people understand it's going to change. So they're constantly working on trying to make it so that it bends and changes in ways that benefit them personally. What steward type people may want to consider also is that, hey, if it's going to change, maybe we should be constantly trying to modify it and adjust it in ways that, because, or modify it in ways that produce better outcomes for society and for a system that works, that hard work is rewarded, and you know, like there is some level of a safety net or whatever. Because the thing is that while I point to the New Deal as a system that actually worked for a large society that delivered the largest middle class in the history of the world, and it did not have out of control wealth equality and so forth. I don't think you could just do that again. You have to take the lessons from that and then implement a new system that leverages what that did well, but also updates it for what's happening now. You know, so if you understand that the thing is going to change and you're proactive about, okay, well, what do we need to do to change it? Then you can stay on top of this, and because it's going to change. It's going to change. And if you don't, then, and I think it's basically, it's a little lazy to just say, hey, let's just blow up capitalism and let's do socialism. Because you know what? Socialism has problems too. You know, and right now, even in the United States, we have more of a quasi-system anyway. We have things that have socialism type aspects to them, and we have things that have capitalism type aspects. You know, so it's lazy to just say, oh, we're just going to do this. Oh, we're just going to do that. You actually have to take a little bit of thought and effort, and or put public servants in office who actually would care about the greater good as opposed to just themselves, and have them work on ways to continue to tweak and adjust the system to get better outcomes out of it. Because one, capitalism won't take you there on its own. And two, it's going to continue to evolve. And you got to be on the forefront of that evolution if you want to ride that engine and not have it blow up on you.
Yep. That was very eloquent and beautiful, but I'm going to have to disappoint you here and just let you know, most of us out here are lazy. And so we are going to continue to look for simple answers, whether it be capitalism or socialism. Yes, that scratches our back emotionally and that confirms our pre-existing biases. That's one thing I can guarantee is going to continue. I will bet my life on that. How this whole economic thing and capitalism and republics and monarchies and all that plays out, that's for someone else.
No, for sure.
And to your point, I'll just finish.
Say you're right about that.
Yeah, I'll just finish and say
that's
yes.
One thing I can guarantee.
Yeah, it's well, yeah,
you
know, I'll
you
say
said
that
it in a show a long time ago, and I've never let you forget it. Sometimes people are human beings too. Yeah, I love it.
They are.
That was one of my favorite quotes. So sometimes,
see, you used to make fun of me with that, but I feel like now, after all these years and all this psychological learning we've done about people, you really embrace it.
I loved it all along. I mean, it was genuine. It was a genuine quote. It's like, you know what? I loved it. So I wasn't making fun of you. I just had fun with it.
I'm gonna start changing it to where primates just to prove the, you know, make the point more pronounced. But yeah. So, but anyway, man, we can wrap because I know that I got stuff. I had something else to say and now I forgot it about the largest. It's all good.
I hit you with the sometimes people are human beings too, man.
And you just got me thinking about being lazy. So yeah, now I'm gonna go smoke a joint and just, you know, finish my day that way. So,
Man, there you go.
Let's go.
All right, man. Well, now we appreciate all you for joining us on this episode. Call like I see it. Subscribe to the podcast, rate it, review it, tell us what you think, send it to a friend. Until next time, I'm James Keys.
I'm Tunde Golana.
All right, we'll talk soon.